a summer disobedience school that Occupy Wall Street's folks in Direct Action are doing. 12 p.m. every Saturday at Bryan Park, people are discussing, learning, and sharing how to conduct nonviolent civil disobedience. An amazing, talented group of people are leading that.
I heard great report backs from the initial offering from summer school.
Oh,
I wasn't
great.
Able to make it, but I heard that it was really amazing.
And this is happening noon every Saturday at Bryan Park, and it's going to be leading up to graduation day, which will be September 17th, Occupy Wall Street's one-year anniversary. Many people are very excited. I also briefly mentioned the summer solidarity with Quebec. There's going to be a citywide Quebec solidarity meeting. We're encouraging everyone from around the city who is wanting to support Quebec from here in New York City to come on Sunday, June 3rd, at 6 p.m. at 16 Beaver. And it's going to be a great meeting. We'll be having people Skyping in who are student leaders from Quebec, also people who went to Quebec and will be coming back reporting on it. And also the May Day Free University has another free university that's coming up on Juneteenth, June 19th, Emancipation Day. It's going to be in Bed-Stuy, and we're going to be having some more details about that. But folks in the Bed-Stuy community had reached out to Free University about having basically an emancipation, anti-racist, people's social movement history kind of Free University theme for Juneteenth. And so June 19th, please mark your calendar for that too.
Can you tell us more about Free University and where we can find all this information?
Yes, Free University is still making its mark on the interwebs, but you can find out more information on OccupyCUNYNews.org. Also, the MayDayNYC.org/Free University site for Free University when it was connected to May 1st activities. There's some contact info there. And you can always email folks at Free University at MayDayFreeU@gmail.com.
Well, Connor, thank you for being with us on Occupy Wall Street Radio. What an amazing conversation.
Thank you.
I want to say thank you to our engineer, Michael G. Haskins, and also thank you to the technical producer for Occupy Wall Street Radio, Reggie Johnson. This program can be heard every day. This program can be heard Monday through Friday from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Please tune in and make sure that you support. Remember, this is listener-supported WBAI 99.5 FM. We are not here without your support. Give us a call at 212-209-2950 and pledge in support of Occupy Wall Street Radio. Have a great evening, folks.
The Clearwater Great Hudson River Revival takes place on Saturday and Sunday, June 16 and 17 at Croton Point Park in Croton on Hudson, New York. This year's Clearwater Festival features world-class musical acts such as David Amram, Holly Near, Joan Osborne and the Holmes Brothers, the Klezmatics and Toshi Regan and Big Lovely, as well as Storytellers and the Green Living Expo. The festival is wheelchair accessible, and most stages are staffed with American Sign Language interpreters. For more information, go to clearwaterfestival.org.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York, where the time is 7:01. You're listening... Well, you're not listening yet, but you will be listening to Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I
And a very good evening, Tribe. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Excuse me, I'm a little bit jet lagged and just back from overseas. Just back from London and Manchester and other wonderful places like that. Joined tonight by Mike.
Hello.
Red Hacked.
Hello.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Kyle.
Pee wee.
Okay. You brought that back from overseas, didn't you?
Yeah.
And Jim.
Hello.
And down in Philadelphia is Bernie S. Is it? Wait, did you not put Bernie S?
It's right there.
Oh, there he is. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
There
you are. Sorry. Greetings from Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania. Okay. Yeah, here we are. It's we were preempted last week. We're back this week. And just a little confused, running around, hitting walls, things like that. But it's the last week of our fundraiser. Thank God for that. We have something completely different, new and different for you this week. We'll be getting into in just a little bit. But first, any updates from anybody on what's going on, Red Hacked? I know you're running out early because of something happening in the sky. What's up?
Yeah, Manhattan Henge. It's when the sun sets and it lines up perfectly with the grid of Manhattan, and it looks really cool. And I've never seen it, but I'm moving soon, so I want to see it before I
But you could have done this yesterday.
I could have done it yesterday, except I didn't know about it yesterday.
Well, actually, you know,
I was here about it afterwards, right? And so this time I heard about it at least with one day's notice. So now I'm gonna see.
When did this become Manhattan Henge? Because I remember back in the 80s, we used to do this. The June 2600 meeting always would have the sun falling down the sky, down the streets of every numbered street, and it was cool.
I think the term was coined by Neil deGrasse Tyson. Look, I don't know when.
Uh huh. Okay. Well, it's just good to be able to name things after Manhattan, even when they're. So that takes place usually June and July, I think. Most of June.
No,
July.
I think it's at the. Yeah, maybe.
In some form, anyway. And of course, I guess different things happen in Brooklyn, the way the streets are there.
Probably.
Yeah.
They don't really have long.
Yeah, they don't have
a
grid, right? That's the important part, because everything in New York is kind of lined up so nicely.
It's more complicated.
Yeah.
Very
Actually,
true.
It's simpler.
Uh-huh.
You know, a lot of European cities are all windy and whatnot. Like, you probably noticed that in London. They don't have a grid there. Everything
we did notice. Kyle and I will give you some background on what the streets are like over there. Yes, Bernie.
We have a bit of news about our friend Julian Assange.
Can you hold your horses for a minute
while we talk about
the heavens, the skies above us?
I will woe the horses.
All right, yeah, because we have a lot to talk about this hour, and we're going to get to that. But we're still talking about the sun and the sun being in the sky, and also how it relates to 2600 meetings, because, as I said, in June, that's when Manhattan Henge happens. This Friday coming up, Rob, I believe you know this, it's a 2600 meeting, correct?
Yes, indeed. And it's a special
one,
isn't it?
It's a very special 2600 meeting. You want to tell us why this is special?
Because it is the 25th anniversary of the very first 2600 meeting.
Wow.
Yeah. 25 years. Can you believe that?
Yeah. We're starting on year 26 of 2600 meetings.
That's something, too. But the very first meeting happened the first Friday of June in 1987.
It would have been June 5th.
How about that? That is something. We're back here in the studios after being preempted last week. And Kyle and I were over in the United Kingdom doing all kinds of interesting things, meeting up with a lot of our listeners and having a real blast. Kyle, anything that you'd like to sum up in the opening moments?
Wow. Yeah, actually, meetings came up when we were in London itself. Some of the London 2600 people were talking to us about their meeting and some of the issues that are affecting it. And they're really trying to bring in new people and expand the kinds of things that people are doing out there, and like with hackerspaces and other things that affect the community there. But we were around the city of London proper, and then we also got out into like some of the country and other parts of it. We went to Manchester, and we're just like taking it in. There's a lot of odd things, like the whole left-hand side driving, and
drive on the other side of the road there, and you learn that pretty quickly.
Yeah, you might say it's the wrong side. But I guess over here, it's the wrong side,
and,
too.
And the other thing, I've done this before, but this is the first time you did it. We rented a car, drove around, and they don't tell you. I mean, obviously, you're supposed to know. But when they give you the car, they don't even say to you, are you concerned that you might not be able to drive on the wrong side of the road and shift a manual transmission, things like that? No, just assume that you'll get it. You get it pretty quickly.
And the wrong side of the car.
Well, yeah, there's that too. You're shifting
so
with
you're
your
shifting
left hand.
Shifting with your left hand, right.
And the steering wheel's over there.
But you did that in London?
No, actually, we rented the car in Sheffield, was it?
It was in the city of Sheffield.
Sheffield.
We took a train there.
And we drove to Manchester and met up with our listener friend Dave. And met so many cool people in Manchester.
Yeah.
It really was a lot of fun.
He's participating and sort of organizes a lot of what goes on at this space called Mad Lab. In Manchester, we were kind of shown around a little bit and got a little flavor of the city. We wanted to see some of the pubs and see some of the like nightlife if there is any. It does close a little bit early there.
Things
that,
do
that
close
was a bit
early.
Odd.
Things do close early over there. We met all kinds of characters. Linda, I believe, is one of them.
Oh,
gosh, basically revolves around the street on a nightly basis and talks to all kinds of people that pass her by.
She was a real kick.
Frank Gallagher, another interesting character of the city that we talked to a bit. There are just so many characters. And
yes.
I wish we had more time to really go into some of the... maybe on Off the Wall we'll go into that a little bit more. But what we did after Manchester, this is what's really interesting. We drove to a place. This is why we rented the car in the first place. We drove to a place called Menwith Hill. And Bernie, I believe you might know something about this odd-sounding place called Menwith Hill.
Yeah, it's part of the whole UK-USA alliance, which is the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, and New Zealand, and all the electronic intelligence agencies, the National Security Agency, GCHQ, all these electronic intelligence, basically spy entities, have this big network of listening posts and monitoring posts. And Menwith Hill is one of the big ones in that network. There's all kinds of crazy antennas there. You probably saw. Did you see a lot of big radomes, big satellite antennas there?
There were a lot of big white, what looked like big white balloons or
golf balls,
bombs. Yeah.
Well, this is what happened. All right, we drove up there. We didn't know what we were going to find. Everyone told us we'd just come upon a hill, and all of a sudden there'd be all these huge golf ball looking things on the hill, and that's pretty much what happened. But when we got there, we noticed that there was almost always a cop behind us on the road. So we went up there to take pictures. We wanted to take pictures for the next hacker calendar of 2013, whose theme, as we've mentioned on this show, is surveillance. And Kyle's one of the photographers, so that was his assignment, to go up there and risk life and limb to take pictures of these big, huge golf balls that nobody really knows what they're doing. Exactly what they're doing anyway.
Why don't you just take a picture of a small golf ball and then blow it up for the publication?
That's your way of doing it. And, it might fool the people some of the time, but we wanted the real thing. And what we did was we drove around. Kyle, you've got a great sense of direction, so I would just get completely lost, but you're basically pointing, okay, you go over this hill now and down this road. Roads we had seen once. And what was the name of that odd-sounding place that we had to go down the road and follow the sign for? Some school or something? It was
the Blubberhouses?
Blubberhouses. I mean, you Blubberhouse know, Road even a name like that, I couldn't remember. But we drove down the Blubberhouse Road, and we were trying not to be seen by cops taking pictures, because you do get questioned if you take pictures of these sites. In fact, there are these two grandmothers over there who have made it their mission in life to take pictures and to actually break into the facility itself, to walk on the grounds, because they've lived there, I imagine, all their lives, and are rather offended by all this surveillance going on right in their backyards. So they've been sent to jail a few times. They've gotten a lot of publicity, but they're really pretty inspirational. We didn't want that to happen to us. We didn't want to wind up in a holding cell or just even being questioned. We just wanted to take the pictures and get out of there and go back to Manchester and hang out in a pub. But we lucked out. We went down a road, a little driveway, actually, just to get off the main road. And there was something rather disturbing about the road. It said do not enter or something. It was very private.
It had an automated gate with a stop sign on it,
yeah.
And then like a keypad and a camera and a bunch of really kind of ominous stuff. And it was
that's not the kind of road to go down when you don't belong somewhere. And what was the phrase you used that I really don't want to go down this road or something like that? Or
yeah, I was like, stop, you know, I don't want to continue on. I don't want to go through there.
So we were about maybe, what, 50 feet away from the gate?
Yeah, we were really quite far away from it.
I was going to back out at that point.
Right.
And what do you think happened? The gate went up. The gate just something was watching us, or someone was watching us, and decided that we were okay to go through. And at that point, you just have to say, you know, let's accept the invitation. They opened the gate, so why not just go down there and see what happens?
Well, it
could be a trap. You're right, Bernie. It could have been a trap. But you know what? They opened the gate. It's not like we tried to get in and used fake ID or anything like that. We just pulled the car into a road, and the gate went up. So we went through that gate. And we passed this building with a parking lot. And what was it? Network operations or something?
Yeah, it was it was some private company like Babcock or some network communication center. It was adjacent to the RAF Menwith Hill facility by like about a farm.
Uh-huh. And then, yeah, farms all over the place.
What? A farm is not a unit of measurement.
Well, it is there because that's the only thing they really have. Sheep farms all
but
over the place.
You can have a big farm. You can have a little farm.
Okay, so
you
like,
could have a farm on your windowsill.
Yeah, it's true. But
okay, no, that's a good point. Like, okay, 40 acres or 100 acres. I don't know. A long distance from the actual facility. Because we went in very close to sort of get very close to these mushroom-like looking things. And, mm-hmm. and that's where we saw a lot of like heavy police patrol. But then we kind of zigzagged our way and got a little bit started further out and worked our way in and then left after that. But this seemed like an access road because there were other antennas that were also they looked sort of related to kind of the whole surveillance concept in the area. But again, this was all adjacent. So there was like some communications center and then a couple like other odd antennas, but they were seemingly like on private property because they were in the middle of what was several residences or several large farms. So the reason for the gate was either people working at this network communications center, which was like privately operated, or it's a pass through for local farms and people that obviously are residents and need access. And we got mistaken either one way or another, and we're able to walk through the lot.
Working for the network, we weren't working for the farm, so we just passed through there and parked the car. And basically, what we wound up doing was staring out at a field of sheep and watching them while you were taking pictures of the radon, the golf balls in the distance.
Yes.
For I think about an hour and a half. And I was just basically standing there making comments about all the sheep and looking like I was interested in that.
Yeah.
And we actually got a bunch of photos with both sheep and surveillance.
Yeah, there's some really funny, cute ones like with sheep surveying me, and it's juxtaposed with these large radomes. So I don't know. We might have some humorous shots in there, but
we got out of there. We got out of there okay. There was no the gate basically went up, and we came up to it on the way out, and then we actually drove up very close to the entrance too, and took some pictures there, and then hightailed it out.
Yeah, that was the last thing we did. We went back and.
Bernie, I want to ask you these golf ball devices, which I don't know where you would see them in this country, if there is any place that you might. Where might you see one?
Well, you could also just follow the Delaware Grill down to Fort Meade, Maryland, where the National Security Agency is headquartered. They're the ones that really are linked, networked to all these antennas at these different countries.
Right, but most people aren't close to that. Are there other places throughout the country where you might see something like that, airports maybe?
Some airports, yeah. I mean, the reasons they look like giant golf balls is inside of that dome is a satellite dish, but it's part of being sneaky and you know, operational security. You don't want your target or anybody else who might be up to no good like you guys to see what satellite the antenna is pointed at. So you put it inside this big sphere, like it's hollow in there. It's called a radome. And that just keeps the weather out of it, and it keeps prying eyes from seeing where it's pointed.
Interesting.
Radomes are used on all kinds of satellite antennas. You could see them on Navy ships. A lot of times they're just there just to keep the weather out of the dish. But in this case, they're there to conceal where the antennas are pointed.
Can I get one for my satellite TV, which always goes out whenever it rains?
Yes, you can, as a
really?
Matter of fact. Although
wow.
It has to be a special material that's transparent to radio frequency energy. Otherwise, it's got to be special paint. Like when I was in, I think it's Teufelsdorf, outside of Berlin last summer, with some friends after the CCC camp. We traveled to an NSA, a retired NSA facility that was in the former West Berlin, pointing towards East Berlin. And there were some massive radomes there that were abandoned. And I was able to cut some pieces of the material. It's a very special, expensive material. It's transparent to RF energy. But I had to take a souvenir, you know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, that was our trip up there. We got some really amazing photos of that, and basically spent a lot of time hanging out in various other parts of the country. And we visited Julie O'Dwyer, who we had on the radio show a month or so ago, whose son Richard is in the process of fighting extradition to the United States for the crime of running a website that linked to movies that the MPAA said were not legitimate. Someone who is not a native of this country, and it wasn't a crime in the country that he was in. Talked to his mother for a good long bit, and she really is an incredible person, the fight that she's involved in. And I think it's kind of indicative of some of the things that are going on, this fight against extradition that seems to be prevalent everywhere.
Yes, like inequity and rendition, like extraditing people from countries where like Americans are protected and can't be extradited, and yet we're extraditing people here routinely and charging them, especially with these things that are like where instances where people have never even been on our land at all.
I believe this ties in rather nicely with what Bernie wanted to bring up before.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
There you go. There you go. So, and is there something you'd like to tell us, Bernie?
Well, yeah. There's some news about Julian. This is big news on BBC last night and this morning. They're the equivalent of the United Kingdom's Supreme Court made a ruling about Julian's pending extradition to Sweden to just answer questions. He's not even been charged with any crime, to just answer questions in Sweden. He's been fighting this because he thinks that that's just sort of a stepping stone to being extradited to the U.S., where the U.S. apparently has convened a grand jury panel to investigate him for leaking classified documents via WikiLeaks. The U.K. Supreme Court ruled that the extradition is valid and that he has to go to Sweden. But he was given 2 weeks, 14 days, to appeal on some really narrow piece of case law that's like decades old, which he's probably going to lose. So he's getting his head together because he's going to probably have to go to Sweden in a couple of weeks and be questioned and then maybe be criminally charged there on sort of dubious charges. And that might lead to his being coincidentally, our Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is going to Stockholm, Sweden, right around now to talk with the government there about things. I wonder what she wants to talk to them about.
Well, it's disturbing to say the least, but not surprising. And it's something that, Julian has 14 days now to appeal this case in one final way, I guess. There's two ways this can go. If the Supreme Court hears it and realizes that it wasn't presented properly in the first place. That's one way of going. Personally, I don't think they're going to be very open to that, because they just haven't shown themselves to be very open to that in the past. Second way is to appeal to the European Union Court of Human Rights, I believe, or something similarly named. If that goes through, if he goes through that court, then it's we're talking months again. But again, that's something that I'm not sure what the odds are, but it's something that we certainly have to keep our eyes open for. We saw Julian and spent quite a bit of time talking, hanging out, basically trading all bits of information. For those interested, he's looking well. In fact, you wouldn't recognize him. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, he looks really well, though.
He does.
He's keeping his spirits up in light of what's going on, and is really the same guy, like, on top of it, and knows a lot of what's going on with right now with, like, Lebanon and, like, what's been happening
in Syria.
It's
something, because we talked to him about what was it like to talk to the leader of Hezbollah, which he did in the first episode of his television program for Russia Today. And it's not like what you would think. It really isn't. Obviously, things are presented on television and through the media in various ways. And it's just, talking about people being starstruck, talking to the leader of Hezbollah and what he has to contend with and things like that. Obviously, there are all kinds of other more complicated issues involved with a person like that. But just to actually be in that kind of a conversation, talking to people that have that sort of contact, that's what's really fascinating. Interesting people that we met up with. Cory Doctorow, we talked to him, hung out with him for a while. As we mentioned, Julia Dwyer, the folks over at the 2600 London gathering. Who did we have? We had Zap, we had Russell, we had Bob. We had Pan. Who else? There were other people, weren't there? I don't want to leave anybody
out. Did some of these people have names longer than three letters?
No. Russell's name is longer than three letters. And I want to congratulate Russell for becoming a father while we were there.
Wow.
Yeah. Mia, his new daughter, is now part of the world after taking 3 days to actually be born. So sympathies to Russell's wife. Lots of cool people.
Also Crypt.
Crypt, yes, of course. I knew I was forgetting somebody. Yeah,
me too. I was trying to think of who it was, but they were brilliant.
And one final thing, and then we're going to move on to other things that we're going to talk about today. Getting into this country, as you know, I've been going through nightmares every damn time, questioned and searched and all that kind of thing. So the last time I got fed up, I wrote a letter to DHS demanding to know why I was on some kind of a list. They sent me back a letter. I opened it live on the air a few months ago. It didn't really say anything. Just said, well, sometimes people's names are confused with other names, and there really shouldn't be any problem. I was convinced there would be a problem, and what happened was we kind of plotted on the way back in. I was going to come into the country with absolutely nothing on me, nothing in my pockets, nothing in my knapsack, and so except for the letter and my passport. And so when they asked me questions, I was just going to say, hey, I'm asking the questions this time because you have absolutely nothing to look at. There's nothing on my bags. There's nothing on my person. But instead, what happened was I walked through the gates, and the guy looked at my passport and looked at the screen. Apparently didn't see anything. He said, welcome home. And that means a lot when you come into your own country and you're welcomed. That hasn't happened to me in a while. So I'm glad that nightmare hopefully is over.
I would hold on to the letter.
I am holding on to the letter, and it's a cautious optimism I've got right now. But it was good. It was good to do that, because when I went to the UK, same thing. Welcome. No questioning, no searching, nothing like that.
Did you have to? I hear they have like multi-hour. They call them queues for immigration at Heathrow.
No, it wasn't so bad at all. Was it bad for you, Kyle? You came in as an American. I came in as an EU citizen.
I had a little bit of questioning and. I get it. Sometimes it was a little bit more than usual about like my occupation and whether I was there to work. But I just sort of said mostly of leisure and I guess it's kind of funny. Like for someone who's into photography, if you're like self-employed, I mean, I told him I was self-employed, and he was asking me like, "Well, what are you doing with your photography lately?" Now he was already like going to like stamp stuff, but it was a sort of an odd question. And I didn't, I say, you know, I'm going to tour and do stuff like that. And I guess people traveling for fun, they take pictures too. And so when I have like four cameras with me or whatever, it's for fun and for leisure. But I don't know if there's like a gray area with photographers. But I don't know. I answered as truthfully as I could and tried not to think of it as too much of a paradox.
Manuel, did you get to go through the part where you don't talk to anyone, or did you talk to an immigration person?
On the way in to the UK.
On the way into the UK.
Well, there was a person there.
When I went into the UK, they had a separate line for people with the EU passport with the chip on it, and I was able to
go chip. I don't have a chip.
Are
and
you
I'm,
sure?
I'm not when registered. I got it a bunch of years ago, probably about 5 years ago, I think. Had it for a while.
Does it have a little symbol on the passport, on the cover, like a little square symbol?
I don't think it does. I don't think I have one of those.
Oh.
I know
well, what you're talking about. Then you can't use that line.
Well, I didn't know it existed anyway, so
well, they were directing. Out. When I was there, when I went there last time, they were directing. They said, if you have got the passport with the chip, please come into this line, and I did. And
I had an Oyster card.
Yeah.
You know, that's what you use to ride the underground, but that didn't... it's really a good system what they have over there. It's incredibly fast and efficient, which is not in London's tradition, but it works really well. What is in London's tradition, though, is surveillance. Oh, my God, it's everywhere. I mean, Kyle, you saw this for the first time. I'm not exaggerating, right?
Yeah, really, like, seeing the city as an adult and walking around and checking things out, seeing how things work and... different. I don't know. The surveillance industry there is mature, and you know, we learned a lot about the schemes and the scheme system. Basically, an installation of surveillance in any given place is called a scheme, and so and because of like a FOIA like policy they have, you can submit to
Freedom of Information Act.
Yeah, it's kind of like that, but a little distinct in that it's just mainly like you can request to see video or clips of you and have them sent of like wherever you're surveilled there. And so there's different schemes. Some are like really quite public and integrated, like the train system or, you know, in public places like that, or like just an average store might have a private scheme, but there's a whole industry. So sometimes there are like different companies that provide it. And we even saw like barcodes for different schemes. You go to a website and submit your claim there. And it just was really bizarre learning about some of that stuff.
There was one part of King's Cross Station where you saw how many security cameras at one time?
Yeah, I was at King's Cross and I was sort of just looking around and taking some wide shots of the timetable board there, which is a big open space, but I counted about 64 cameras in any like in a 360-degree view.
So this is without moving around.
Yeah,
you could
just
see 64 different cameras.
Right, just pivoting. Yeah,
incredible. And this is the case inside buses and trains, on the street, and just watching. And people are used to this. People think it's a normal part of life. I heard something on the radio where people were being offered lower car insurance if they agreed to have a video camera installed inside their car. And the controversy was that the cost of insurance was still too high. Nobody said anything about the privacy concerns. Not one person mentioned that. It was just about the cost. People just are content with being watched all the time. And the thing that really mystifies me, it's not a society where something like this is seems particularly needed in the first place. People want to be safe. Yeah, people want to be safe everywhere. But it's not like people in England were unsafe before or were subjected to more crimes than any other country. And it's also weird because we were told this on a number of occasions, criminals know where the cameras are. And so they commit the crimes right outside where the cameras are. They know where the blind spots are, or they go into a part of the country that doesn't have surveillance. And so maybe that means they need more cameras.
Yeah, that's what they – so there's a blind spot, so they got to put a camera there so they don't commit the crime there.
Uh-huh. And, of course, also lots of cameras are unmanned. And you find this out when you decide you need some footage. Maybe you got mugged in a certain area and you want to see what happened, and the authorities tell you that, well, we didn't change the tape that particular week. So it's an inefficient system, but kind of a scary one, and really something that we should learn from, because it's going to come here. It's going to come here if you're not careful. What's that, Bernie?
I said nothing.
Well, you should say something. We should all say something.
Yeah,
but
I mean, you probably can't walk even a few yards in and I won't say meters because they're still on the English system of measurement in the UK. You can't even walk a few yards there in anywhere in London without being surveilled by more than one technology.
Absolutely. All right, well, we're going to move
on. This is Julian Assange, and you're listening to Off the Hook at WBAI New York.
Okay, well, thank you, Julian, for that. And he does extend his greetings to everyone back here. And, of course, we'll be hearing more from him later on as well. And what a country to be stuck in when you're trying not to be surveilled. Wow. Okay, we're moving on to tonight's a topic of our fundraising endeavors. And that's something that keeps this radio station on the air, keeps us going, by calling 212-209-2950. You can support this particular radio station. Joining us tonight is Deviant Alam. And Deviant, am I pronouncing that last name correctly?
Almost. You're pronouncing it traditionally in the sense that most people do say Alam, but it's actually pronounced Olive.
Olive with a V?
Almost with a V sound, yes.
But it's spelled it's spelled O-L-L-A-M.
Is it? That it is.
But it's pronounced with a V.
Yes.
All right. Well, at least I know how to pronounce deviant. That's
yes,
that's not
do.
A problem. Okay. You're a member of the open organization of lockpickers, known as Tool, I believe.
Yes, yes. We are looking forward to being a presence at Hope, as has been in the past.
And we certainly are looking forward to having you there. Can you first tell us something about the organization? I know it had its starts overseas in mm-hmm. Holland and in Germany and eventually became a big force here in the United States.
Yes, indeed. Well, sport picking, as you have highlighted, has been a factor of game and hacker community activities overseas. Originally, it was the Dutch who had sport picking organizations with names like Door Hardware Sport and so forth. Or you have the German group, SS Devs, Schrende des Technik, again, really cropping up throughout the 90s and beyond. Tool, which was founded in the Netherlands by Buddy Wells, and of course has been represented even before there was Tool in the U.S. Tool was represented internationally at some of your older Hope events. Tool then grew so much and drew so much support that a U.S. branch of Tool now exists and has in fact grown larger than the small Dutch community, which is still kicking and alive, still doing very, very well. And we have close ties with those guys over there. But now we have chapters all throughout the U.S. and even in New York City, finally. After many false starts, the New York City meeting takes place on the third Tuesday of the month up in Washington Heights at a bar called La Cala.
Wow. Well, that's great news to hear that it's expanded so much and become more popular. What do you tell people who have no conception of what lockpicking is all about or think it's only for criminals?
Well, we just think that it's a really fun puzzle, you know. We can tell people that there are many ways that you might choose to explore the world and might choose to learn new skills that could be considered criminal or dangerous. I mean, you could say that it sounds almost as strange to us as someone saying, ooh, your kid takes Kung Fu or Aikido. Boy, that those martial arts, is he some kind of criminal? Is he going to go out and mug people? And you say, well, no, it's about a mastery of a unique skill, a new way of thinking, a new way of acting. And we just view locks as a fun challenge. They are a great activity, either solo or in groups. They're a puzzle to be solved. So Tool has and will always be a nonprofit, just academic and research organization designed to convey knowledge to people in a casual hobbyist way with a kind of a tilt towards let's figure out these fun puzzles.
So it sounds like something that really ties into the hacker world as far as solving puzzles and overcoming challenges.
Absolutely. And there is no doubt that there is a certain raised eyebrow factor that appeals very heavily to the hacker types. The fact that it is conflated with this dark knowledge or closed circles of information, it definitely ups the appeal more than, let's say, I don't know, knitting. But, well, they're one and the same. They're just a fun craft with your hands.
Well, the thing about it, too, is in the presentations I've seen given at Hope, you know, there's a lot of research that happens in Tool, and a lot of it gets published. And you know, if there's a lock out there that's horribly insecure in some manner, and people are installing it thinking that it is protecting, you know, their home or their belongings or their office or whatever it is, then, you know, someone is going to figure out that this vulnerability exists, and it's better that it's published and out there and people are aware of it than it just kind of goes under the radar. And so, you know, that's another kind of interesting part of the lockpicking community. I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's like a hacker finding a vulnerability and publishing that. It's the same kind of thing.
Emmanuel. Oh, yeah. We believe very strongly in the whole idea of physical security works in the same principles that digital security does. Openness is what achieves the best results.
Go ahead, Barney.
I just want to mention, you were just talking about it's what Mark was saying about exposing vulnerability of locks. A few years ago, there was the famous kryptonite bicycle lock. Actually, hackers sort of made it well known that you could very easily open one of those with a big pen, ballpoint pen.
Yeah, yeah.
And Kryptonite, the company, or their mother company, to their credit, exchanged them all for a more secure lock. But bikes were getting stolen en masse. You know, lots of bikes were getting stolen because of this vulnerability, and the company didn't do anything about it until the hacker community held them accountable and said, hey, this lock is not secure. And then all was an improved situation. I'm sure Deviant can elaborate on that.
Oh, yes. That was one of the more famous cases. That's a real jaw-dropper simply because of the real low-tech rudimentary tool. I mean, you can't even call it a tool. As Bernie says, it was the plastic barrel portion of a disposable Bic pen, a ballpoint pen, which just happened to be the right shape to fit in the tubular locking keyway, and it was just malleable enough, and the lock was designed with just poor enough tolerances that jamming the pen in there and wiggling it around and twisting it would cause the lock to open many times. For all the listeners, I should point out that it is not a weakness shared by all tubular-style locks, also known sometimes as Chicago or Ace locks, some of which are designed very well. In fact, the original Chicago Lock Company, the maker of what is called the Ace Lock, the proper branded Ace Lock, is a nice lock. But with anything, once patents expire and knockoffs appear, you get a wider range of quality. And this was an example of locks on the lower end of that. And your story is correct. They did change the design, and in the end, you no longer find that classic, you know, U-shaped master bike lock, kryptonite bike lock, with a tubular design key at all.
Well, okay, this leads into what we're offering tonight for the fundraiser here at WBAI. This is something that is offered through Tool, the Open Organization of Lockpickers. It's a beginner's blend pick kit, and what that is a collection of how many of them are there, Deviant?
There are eight.
Eight.
There are two tensioners, two hooks, two rakes, two diamonds.
Okay, and if you know what that means and you know how valuable that is, if you don't know what that means, we can let you know that that will get you started figuring out ways to bypass, to get through certain locks, or to get around things that maybe you locked yourself out of, or just to learn how a lock works in the first place. It's very important to have this skill, this information. A lot of people, a lot of kids are playing with these tools and figuring things out as far as how to open things.
Yeah, at all the hacker conferences I've been to lately, if there's a lock picking tent, it's usually full of children.
It's incredible, yes.
And you know, they'll also have, you know, a children's hour or something where kids can come.
I mean, like 3 or 4 year olds we're talking about that really have skills. It's incredible.
Yeah,
a little
love
scary.
It.
Yeah, isn't it something? It's really incredible.
Yeah, there are a ton of great clips on YouTube if you do a couple of searches for these various hacker conferences, many of which are tools lockpicking tables, and just these young kids getting a hang of it while their parents or guardians are still struggling. And it's great watching a little girl crack open a lock that mystifies her dad.
Yeah, and also they get pretty upset too when they can't do it, and their little toddler kids are able to do it without any kind of so this might be a great little present for a kid, you know, but it also I think will be educational to anybody that picks it up and starts playing around with it and just figuring out how it works. So anyway, you get that. You get the beginner's blend pick kit, but you also get the emergency pick card. And Deviant, what is the emergency pick card all about?
Well, the emergency pick card, which was actually designed by one of our board members, Babak Javadi, is a pick kit that you can keep with you at all times. Now, something we should point out, speaking of this, there's nothing that really prevents anyone from keeping picks on them at all times, most of the places they would go. Many of your listeners may have questions about legality. Picks in general, lock picks, are not treated as illegal in most jurisdictions. They should, of course, check with their local laws. We can get into that in a bit, though, if they have further questions. But as far as picks being carried everywhere goes, you know, picks are tools that are about 5 to 6 inches long, and you have them in a little tube. You don't always have that shoved in your pocket. The emergency pick card, however, is the exact same size as a credit card. It slips right in your wallet, and the frame and the entire metal body of the card can be snapped apart and turned into a functional set of picks and tensioners. This is, you know, something that often brings to mind, let's say, the business card of our friend Kevin Mitnick, who's been at Cannes. And we don't mind that analogy too much. Of course, he's very prominent and everyone sees that. But Kevin will tell you his card is a novelty tool. He likes lockpicking, and that's why he designed his business card the way he did, out of thin stamped aluminum. Our emergency pick kit, however, is actually made of proper 301 hard steel. It's the same steel used in our high-end Tool Fabulous 5 set. And it is a real, really fully fledged picking kit. You can actually open locks with it as opposed to just sort of show off your cool interests.
Well, let me just break in and say that we can get both of those, the Beginner's Blend Pick Kit and the Emergency Pick Card, for a pledge of $75, which is really pretty low for those two items. And unique, too, because it's only going to be offered for the next 20 minutes. And I have to step in and do this now because we haven't really been pushing. We've been talking about a lot of stories and other things, and we're supposed to be raising money this hour, and we've gotten no calls because we haven't been asking for them. So we need to get a flurry of people calling in. I see one call on the line already, which is great, but we need to fill up those phone lines quickly so that we don't get lectured after the show by people who said that we should have been raising more money. Again, it's the last week that we're doing this. We won't be doing it next week, and it won't be happening after 8 o'clock either. 212-209-2950. Pledge of $75 gets you the Beginner's Blend Lockpick Kit and the Emergency Lockpick Card, which is definitely something that you won't see offered on NPR or anywhere else. I can tell you that right now. For a pledge of $125, you'll get all that, plus you'll get a full DVD set of every lockpicking talk that has ever been presented at the Hackers on Planet Earth conferences, and that will encompass all the European lockpickers who have come to our conferences and the American lockpickers and all kinds of different stories throughout the years of various advances and changes in lock technology. Really educational to have those DVDs as well. So that's a pledge of $125, 212-209-2950. $75, you get the kit and the card with all kinds of lock picks that you will learn from and that you can experiment with.
A lot of those talks too are pretty funny because, you know, they'll show you the lock and how it's supposed to be so difficult to get into, and then it just kind of falls apart in this hilarious way, the security of the locks.
Right. It's the parallel to hacking is really incredible because when you try and defeat something over and over again, you get people involved in trying to defeat something, you will defeat it one way or another. And hardware is a great way to experiment with that theory. And this is the best way I can think of where you at home, in the safety of your home, can experiment with your locks and figure out how secure, how safe they actually are. Don't take the manufacturer's words. Don't take anyone's words, but other people, other consumers, and your own experiences. 212-209-2950. Join the people calling in right now. And get these kits, these cards, these DVDs. It's really an incredible deal.
I had a quick question for Deviant. So let's say somebody, when people pledge and they receive their lock picks, where can they go to find information on how to get started and how to learn if they're not at Hope necessarily?
Indeed. Well, you can always just point your internet tube, you know, at the Googles is a sort of a broad scattershot way. But for more specifics, we always recommend if people want to check out Tool, that's T-O-O-O-L, so three O's. So tool.us or tool.nl is the Dutch site, our other counterparts over there. But the tool.us site does also contain links to basically all of our presentations and other materials, all of the resources that we use when running Lockpick Villages. It's all up there. all the diagrams. There are links that lead from there to my site, or people can just kind of Google my name and find me. I put all of my animations and diagrams and content all online. As Emmanuel has said, of course, those DVDs, the presentations, having the actual videos from the talks are great, because people, you know, put a lot of time and effort into trying to show, you know, really show something visual on the screen. It's not, as you guys know, it's not your usual presentation. It's not just a lot of text on a page. It's a lot of good video and images that gets put up there.
Emmanuel?
Yes, Bernie, go ahead. Please bring in some calls. We have two on the line right now. I think a third one coming in, but we really need to bring in a lot more than
as
that.
As Stephen was saying, some of these Hope videos are great. We use a high-resolution document camera, so the speaker actually points a camera down into the cylinder of the lock. So on the big screen at Hope, you can see down inside the lock and see the actual picking of the cylinder and manipulating the lock. But this is a great opportunity. If you've ever been curious about locks, if you've ever locked yourself out of some place, and who hasn't, wouldn't you feel more secure having a lockpick set in your wallet or in your pocket? Call 212-209-2950. This is a great, I mean, besides just having, you just feel more confident when you know you could walk into almost, you'd be like Gumby. You can walk into any door.
let's exercise some caution here, because we don't want people, you know, breaking into liquor stores high security vehicles and things like that. It's knowledge does not have to be used just for criminal intent. It's used for education. That's what we've been trying to push for many, many years now.
Yeah, and absolutely. And if you don't want to use the skill to open up something that you shouldn't, you can use what you learn to protect things that you want to, and that you think should be secured. You can learn what not to do. You can learn how worthless the generic locks that everyone has in their front doors really are. It's a real eye opener, this stuff. If you've never looked into it, if you've never been into it before, it really changes the way you look at a lot of what we take for granted about security.
And you don't need special skills other than the ability to learn and experiment. And when you get this kit, I think you'll learn a lot more as far as how it's all put together, how the lock actually functions, and then you'll be able to tell if something is secure in the future.
Yeah, please call 212-209-2950 and pledge. I personally would be interested in a kit like this, having the tools just on your person, and even if you've never done it before, and you don't really understand how lockpicking works. If you have the tools, kind of like the radio station, if you have the tool, you know, you can use it in the heat of the moment. You'll learn pretty quick. I can't even begin to recall how many times I've been maybe locked out of something, or I've needed access to something, and I just had the key. And like, that's critical. Just having the tool. If it's like, wow, I have it in my pocket. I've never done this before, and you're going to be stuck there. You can't get into something. You learn and you know, fly by the seat of your pants, that kind of thing.
And what is a key? A key is basically an access control device that says you have the authorization to do this. And by carrying this kit around, or the emergency pick card, you won't be restricted in what you can access, whether it's something in your house, whether it's your car, whether it's your office. You always have the ability to get around a restriction. 212-209-2950. We have four calls on the line right now. We need to bring in more. Pledge of $75 gets you the beginner's blend lockpick kit with 8 picks that are the pretty basic ones that will get through quite a few locks, I believe. You have the emergency pick card, which you can carry in your wallet or your pocket, and never worry about losing a key again. If you take a little bit of time to learn how it all works and experiment, you'll become quite good at this, and you'll find that that's a skill worth having in many situations, and certainly a good conversation piece too. 212-209-2950 for a pledge of $125. You get the kit and the card, plus a full DVD set of every lockpicking talk that we've ever presented at the Hackers on Planet Earth conferences. 212-209-2950.
And I also want to say about these tools in particular, if you have been into lockpicking, or you've looked at it, you know there are some cheap tools out there. There are some low-quality, junky ones out there. But Tool knows what they're doing. I have a set of the, I have one of the breakaway cards, and it's a really solid piece of equipment for, you know, it really feels like I could pick something with it. I haven't used it yet, but I hope to one day.
You're not afraid to use it, are you?
I'm not afraid of anything.
Well, it's been, you know, what you might be afraid of is that sense of power you get when you actually use it and realize, wow, I understand this. I can make this work. I can do something I didn't think I could do. And this is what the key is actually doing when it goes into the lock. Now I am the key. I'm working it out. I'm figuring out how the whole device operates. It is such a rush when you get that feeling. And that's why kids are drawn to it so much, because they seem to instinctively get that sensation. We're offering this opportunity to our listeners, 212-209-2950.
You know what I am afraid of, though? I'm afraid of losing the card, because it's just really cool in card form, so I may have to get another one. And break that one up.
You'll always have.
Yeah.
The other one is your backup that you can always actually use.
Deviant, let me ask you, someone who gets this, who gets either the kit or the card, and if you call us now, you'll get both, does somebody know instinctively how to use it? Are there instructions? How difficult is this to use for the first time?
Oh, I think if you speak to anyone who's ever actually tried lockpicking and sat down, they'll say it really is easy to pick up. Once you see, oh, this piece goes in here, and I try to turn it a little bit, and then this piece goes in here, and I move. Am I doing it? I'm moving it like this. Am I doing it? Am I doing it? And then all of a sudden the lock opens, and they say, whoa. I guess I was.
I guarantee, I know there are a lot of naysayers out there. There are always a lot of naysayers out there. But in particular, in this particular case that we're talking about right now, a lot of people saying only criminals will want to use this particular type of technology. Utter nonsense, because I guarantee in anybody's life there will come a time where having this skill, having these tools, will be of great benefit to you, could even save a life. There are many instances where I've been unable to get into something I need to get into that I have access to, but for some reason I don't have the key, or someone's stolen the key, or something is malfunctioning. And having the know-how, having the access, having the hardware is really something that comes in very handy. Again, a pledge of $75 gets you two separate devices that will make this so much easier. You get the beginner's blend lockpicking kit, the emergency lockpicking card, provided by the Open Organization of Lockpickers tool here in the USA. Pledge of $75, 212-209-2950, pledge of $125, all of that plus a full DVD set of lockpicking seminars, talks at the Hackers on Planet Earth conference. It's an incredible deal, one that we've never offered before, one that we will not be offering in 7 minutes, because that's when we're off the air. And also, it's the last week of our fund drive, so we won't be offering it next week. Most importantly, the most important reason to call up, though, is to keep this radio station on the air, because we can talk about things like this. Tune to any other radio station. You won't be able to have a conversation about lock picking. No, because to teach people how to pick locks, that's giving up control. And most corporate radio is all about control, right? So this is one small step in that direction, and it pretty much epitomizes what WBAI stands for. If you want to keep that particular bastion of free speech alive, please give a call now, 212-209-2950. Since 1960, that is how we stayed on the air, from people calling in and pledging and showing support and coming up with great ideas for new things to talk about. Tonight's no exception. On this radio station, in a typical week, you'll hear hundreds, thousands of different ideas and alternative viewpoints. Support that. 212-209-2950.
Yeah, someone said it before as sort of a throwaway line, but I really want to repeat that NPR would not offer you lockpicks as a premium. If they did a program about lockpicking, that would be strange enough, but they would offer you as a premium a tote bag with a photograph of a lockpick on it, and it would be great, and NPR would be great, and the program would be great and all that. But WBAI believes that you should have the tools to change your own reality. You should learn to do this. You can do it as a hobby, you can do it for practical purposes, you can do it for no reason at all. But we want you to decide. 212-209-2950 is the number to call to get these lock picks, and you can play with them. See if you like it.
We have two calls on the line right now. Let's make that five.
Emmanuel?
Yes, go ahead, Bernie.
I want everybody listening to WBAI and Off the Hook right now to get a particular look on their face. It's the precious look that I see at every Hope conference in the Lockpick Village, where someone has... a beginner has picked their first lock and it pops open, and it's a look of shock and awe on their face. They can't believe what they just accomplished. And people say it just changed their life. It just opens up doors for them, not to be punny, but it does. Call 212-209-2950. Get that look on your face. You will be so impressed with yourself. You will get a new sense of confidence that you understand. You understand how the locks work in your house, your car, your business, wherever you're allowed to have access to. You know, you'll be able to test to see the security of the locks that you paid a lot of money for and may actually get a false sense of security and realize this is a crappy lock. I better change it. I could pick it in 3 seconds, and so could anybody else.
Okay, we have – go ahead.
212-209-2950. A pledge of $75 gets you the blend pick set and the emergency pick card. Or if you want to pledge $125, you get both of those pick sets plus a complete set of Hope DVDs that show all the Hope lock picking tutorials. Some of them really show you deep inside the lock and how to pick it and so forth. 212-209-2950.
Five calls on the line. We've got five calls on the line. I want to thank people for showing support and realizing what Bernie has been saying, what Deviant has been saying, what so many of us have been saying over the years, that this kind of thing is important, that this matters. Now, the lock picking kit that we're talking about, the first of two, just to get technical here, they include two hooks, a standard and a Euro slim, two half diamonds, a thick hard model and a thin slender one, and two rakes, a snake and a Bogota style wave jiggler. Yeah. Well, I wanted to make sure that was clear.
So the interesting thing, when people hear, a basic pick kit, they think, well, you know, that's something I could get anywhere. And of course that is, sold by many vendors of lock picking and locksmithing supplies. Many of them say, well, here's our starter set. Here's our 10 piece. Here's our 12 piece. Here's our 8 piece. And they all float in this same, little above price range. It's not a real major price investment, but they're all thought of as the same. What you'll get, however, from any vendor, and there are plenty of decent ones out there, you'll tend to get a number of different tools all in the same metal stock, all in the same, cut profile, because supply houses tend to be very loyal to whatever metal they like to use and machine. What Tool has done is cultivated relationships with any number of vendors. So it's not a uniform, homogenous set of, 5, 10 of the same thing. It's a sampling of different tools from different suppliers and different types of metals, different thicknesses, which is really not something anyone could get on their own by themselves. I mean, you could if you bought 7 different pick kits from all around the country and put a few pieces of each into a tube, but then at that point you're spending hundreds of your own dollars.
All right, Deviant, I hate to cut you off, but we are out of time, and we have 7 calls on the line, so that's a great indication that our words are hitting people hard and being heard. You have a couple of minutes if you want to join those people on the phone. If the phone keeps ringing and doesn't answer right away, please call right back. The offer will be here for a few more minutes, not much longer than that. $75, you'll get 2 of the lock-picking kits. For $125, you'll get those plus the DVD set. 212-209-2950. And, of course, more information on Tool can be found at tool.us. And we'll see you again next week with a non-fundraising edition of Off the Hook. Remember the 25th anniversary of the 2600 meetings this Friday in various locations, especially New York, though. And, again, that phone number 212-209-2950. Stay tuned for the Personal Computer Show. Good night.
Yeah. All right, all right, all right, all right. All right, you're listening to WBAI, New York 99.5 FM, also streaming on the web at WBAI.org. It's 8 o'clock, Wednesday, May 30th, 2012, and that always means that you are about to listen to the personal computer shoe. Alrighty.
Good evening. Good evening. This is Hank Key, and I'm on the air with Stevie DB in the studio.
We'll have Michael soon, and David. And
welcome to the Personal Computer Show. We will have joining us this evening Michael Horowitz, our webmaster, and he seldom is on the air, but he's doing me a favor by being on the air tonight. We also have David Perry, who is our Left Coast correspondent, and we're going to have an exciting show for you this evening. We're going to be talking about, well, what's news in the world of personal computing. And one of the big stories right now is the flame. And people are saying, what is the flame? Well, it's a very important virus, and it's huge. And Stevie is setting it up. So in the meantime, let me just say that we are in the final stages, final leg, final part of the run for fundraising. We do have a number of premiums that we have, and let me just go through it briefly, and we're not going to spend too much time talking about it. You can get more information on our website, pcradioshow.org. We have the Personal Computer Show Gold Card Support for $200. That is for personal use for 1 year. We have the DVD 2 kit with another CD password bypass. In other words, there is a separate DVD, what we call toolkits, of all the useful utilities that we've been using, and with it is a separate CD that will fix whatever password that you've forgotten on your Windows system, and the total of those two discs is $75. We have that separate CD password bypass for $50, and we also have it available in USB format for $50.
And we also have Dave and Michael on the phone.
Good.
You know, I would use those utilities if Hank would ever ship them to me.
Well, it's very easy because I understand that you're shipping yourself to the East Coast, and I want to get it to you in that fashion.
Right. I just needed the boot.
Oh, okay.
And nobody shipped it to me.
Okay, I'll get it shipped to you. But I thought you were going to get yourself folded and stuff in an envelope. And so long as we don't,
I will be there in person on the 13th.
Of June.
Of June. In 2 weeks.
Oh, okay.
From tonight.
Oh, you're going to be on the show, Dave?
Yes, he
will. Yeah, I'll be there in person on the show.
Wow.
Yeah, okay. And the last premium we have is a CD called No Backup, No Recovery. And that's essentially, I will complete the segment on it. If not tonight, I'll do it next week. And it's to talk about really backing up and the necessity for it and a different way of doing it. You know, only 10 to 15% of the people really do true backup and or even any meaningful backup at all. And that's a shame because for a lot of people, it's a hassle or it's just too much effort. We're going to try to do it a little differently. So those are the premiums that we have, but we're going to go over it again a little later. In the meantime, we have some hot news, and that has to do with the flame virus. And I guess it's like a pun to say it's a hot news to call it the flame virus. David?
What? You know, it's funny. It's funny. The name flame was taken out of the header of one of the files. And there's a whole bunch of stuff being reported about this, and not all of it is true. I've spent the entire day researching this. I've talked to researchers at Symantec, McAfee, ESET, and the International Computer Security Association.
I also hope you've spoken to Kaspersky.
Of course I spoke to Kaspersky.
Okay, because they're the Russian
outfit.
They were
the first to discover it, but everybody's got it now. Everyone has copies of it.
Okay,
analyze
wait.
It.
The first question is, what is it?
It is not a virus. It doesn't replicate. In order to be a virus, it has to make copies of itself.
Oh.
Like, when you get a virus, you get the virus, and then Stevie can get the virus from you. This has to be targeted.
Wait a minute. If it's not contagious, is the word you're using, yet the Iranians are saying it affected the Ministry of Defense, the Ministry of Agriculture.
It was intentionally sent to all of
those
places.
I'm
not hot dogging you, Hank. It's not a virus. It's a worm.
I read that it actually could spread by itself over a local area network.
Over a local area network, but not from network to network.
Okay.
Tell us, what is it, though?
It's a collection of programs. There's a whole bunch of programs.
Wait. What does it do?
It does a whole bunch of stuff. You're going to have to let me get there, Hank.
We're trying.
This is a gaggle of programs, the largest of which is 6 meg in size. Taken together, they're all 20 meg in size. And that makes it as a collection of malware, as a single exploit or a single caper, it's the biggest single thing ever, right? But no one file is 600 lines of code. It's not like that. It's not one piece of malware. And in it, it's got all kinds of libraries and all kinds of functions and actually a complete language development system. And that's why it's so huge.
Dave?
That it has an interpreted language included with
Dave,
it.
Dave? Yeah. Let me look at the forest and rather the trees. First of all, this is Windows only. Is that correct?
Windows only.
Period.
And it is
no
there.
Mac, no Linux. You have an iPad. You have an Android. You're fine. None
no,
of that.
All Windows, right?
And its main purpose is to steal data from you. It's to
steal
spy on
data.
You.
Wait. Let me jump in. I think the main purpose is to get the Iranians.
Well,
no, because it's all over the Middle East. It's not just in the Iranians.
Okay, go ahead.
It would be easy. We would love to be able to characterize things and read, write the patterns of intention on things, but I wouldn't be so fast. I'm not even ready to say that it was produced by a government, and many, many virus researchers are with me on that. They're saying, well, this is too complicated to have been written by a criminal gang, which I find egregious, okay? On top of that, parts of this are older and parts of this are newer, and it keeps on being compared to Stuxnet, but it shares no code with Stuxnet. It's not even written in the same language.
Okay, let me ask a simple question.
Stuxnet. What is not Dooku?
What are
there isn't any direct evidence
Dave?
Connecting it to the United States of America or
it
to
is,
Israel.
It is spyware in the classic sense of the word, isn't it?
It is spyware. It's there to capture information, and it's got some really interesting pieces to it. It's got a screen scraper, which captures images of your screen. And the reason you do that is that all of the encryption you run in your machine, still the image that hits the screen of your computer is decrypted. So it takes a picture of the screen. It captures individual files. It has a keylogger built into it. And it can even turn on the microphone and your system and listen in. And it can monitor. And this is how it does affect Android. It can monitor devices that are near it via Bluetooth, which is absolutely unique. That's the one unique thing about it.
You're kidding.
Stuff like listening in on the microphone go back 10 and 15 years. None of these things are unique.
It does eavesdropping.
None of them indicate the presence of, because it's in both military installations, government installations, private individuals, and commercial installations in 12 different countries.
But every country in the Middle East.
That it was planted by a phishing email.
All right.
I hadn't heard that we knew how it was planted.
They uncovered a number of phishing emails that plant it. They believe that's the primary way, although it does share with Stuxnet the ability to be planted via a USB key.
Well, I was told that there was 650,000 lines of code.
And all the programs put together.
Now, to put that in perspective, original DOS 1.0 is only 4,000 lines of code, and this is 650,000 lines of code.
Yeah, but
that's huge.
But this is not one file that's that big. This is a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, what I'm saying is this is
all
not...
All of the included libraries are included in that code.
It's not one individual, then, that did it. I don't even think it's one organization. It's got to be a government that did it.
The NSA.
No. I doubt that.
You mean the people in our government are not smart enough to do it?
No, I'm not saying that either. It could be a government, but there's no evidence other than you saying, by golly, that's big. It must be a government that wrote that. A company wrote Windows, and it's 450 million lines of code. And most of that is not written code. Most of it is the included libraries and the language development system. I forget the name of the language. It's the language that Angry Birds was written in, Tua or Lua. And so the whole Lua language interpreter is included with the MAL code.
Who has an interest
in... Most of that was not written by the bad guys.
Who has the interest in making...
In for the wide.
Who has the interest in making such a complicated spy program?
Well, here's the thing, Stevie. It could be a commercial criminal organization that's making it and renting it out to different people for different purposes.
I doubt it.
Oh, no, that happens with most of the malware that we see. There is a big marketplace in malware out there in the world. So there's a possibility it could be that. So we're looking at 18 countries and thousands of people, places and things infected, and you want to tie it to a single purpose.
Let me ask you,
that
when
would
you
make
say
it neater and cleaner.
David, when you say 18 countries, is US part of the 18?
No.
Oh, so you're saying it's
mostly Middle East and Africa.
Exactly.
You mean Nigeria got hit?
I don't have the list in front of me, Hank.
Okay.
But Middle East.
I don't think Nigeria got hit. Normally you only hit places that have, computers in them.
Iran, Syria, Egypt.